南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。Hello friends, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you once again for visiting. Again, as I always say, I truly think about your health, these days especially. And I hope that you're safe in our crazy world today. That is a much neglected asset. Anyway, we are going to continue today with chapter 2 of, where is it? There is Perfection of Wisdom, Edward Tonzi style from the 8,000 lines version. We've read the first stanza of chapter 2, which is titled Where Bodhisattvas Stand. And rather than thinking of that as straight-legged on 2 feet, where bodhisattvas stand, again, is a mental reference. So what is the mental, not position, but ground on which a bodhisattva operates, right? Now we're going to go into wherein bodhisattvas train. So wherein, how do bodhisattvas train? How do we train our minds? Those who wish to become the Sugata's disciples, or Pratyeka Buddhas, or likewise kings of the Dharma, without resort to this patience, they cannot reach their respective goals. So right off the bat, we're not really admonished, but we're drawn our attention to, in order to train what we're attempting to do, to be a follower of the Buddha way as bodhisattvas. Of course, here the rhetoric, as you know, is 2,300 years old, so this isn't the Lotus Sutra. This is an earlier teaching talking about Pratyeka Buddhas, but at least we're talking about learning and realization leading to bodhisattva, right? So these are the early stages of training the mind. They move across, but their eyes are not on the other shore. Those who teach Dharma and those who listen when it is being taught, those who have won the fruit of an arhat, a single Buddha, or a world savior, and the nirvana obtained by the wise and the learned, mere illusions, mere dreams, so has the Tathagata taught us. So this is quite an important statement in that there's an admonition here that yes, you've attained a great deal in your training as an arahant. You've achieved a great deal in your training as a self-enlightened person, understanding your attachments, the nature of all things being provisional and temporary, impermanent, right? All those words come to mind. But to actually instantiate in the mind that you personally are no longer sensing attachment to samsara, that's really great, but you ain't there yet. So it says right now that all of this, in this last line of the fifth line, and the nirvana obtained by the wise and the learned, all you people of learning and realization, perk up your ears, are mere illusions, mere dreams. So has the Tathagata taught us. So as we're Lotus Sutra practitioners, the practitioners of the ultimate teachings, the ultimate method of Shakyamuni's enlightenment, we know what that means. At that time, though, a lot of the people who were learning this perfection of wisdom had to be struggling with that, because most of them would have felt that they had achieved arhat, self-enlightenment, self-awakening, really, that they didn't need any more of this, right? Even in the Lotus Sutra, when Shakyamuni starts to speak to the assembled masses, right at the beginning of the Lotus Sutra, essentially, all these arhats stand up and go, we don't need to hear any more of this. We're already there. And they leave. And what does Shakyamuni say after they're gone? He doesn't say a word till they're gone. Then he looks at the rest of the masses assembled before him and says, well, now that the trash is gone, right? Pretty severe admonishment. These are Ichantikas, people of incorrigible disbelief. They're so self-educated that they think they know it all, but they don't. They have not achieved what they think they have achieved. And Shakyamuni moves on without them. It's a very strong admonishment, and here it is, long before the Lotus Sutra gets widespread. If you think you've won the fruit of an arhat, right? A single Buddha, what you would call yourself, even though you're not, or a world savior, which you're not doing by the very nature of being an arhat, you think that by having released your own attachments to things, that the mere fact that you meditate on that saves the world. No, you've only saved yourself, if that. It's a bodhisattva, coursing as a bodhisattva with intention so that your actions influence and affect others in the midst. You can't go off in a cave and enlighten the world. That's an illusion, a mere dream. And here it is, very early on, really, in the history of Buddhism, right? And the nirvana obtained by the wise and the learned, mere illusions, mere dreams, so that the Tathagata has taught us. So for those who think that the Tathagata, Shakyamuni, the Buddha, only taught this way late in the Lotus Sutra, not even his teaching, he taught it before they wrote the Perfection of Wisdom, before 100 AD, four kinds of persons are not alarmed by this teaching. Sons of the Jina, skilled in the truths, saints, unable to turn back. Arhats, free from defilements and taints, and rid of their doubts. Those whom good teachers mature are reckoned the fourth kind. Coursing thus, the wise and learned bodhisattva trains not for arhatship, nor on the level of a Pratyeka Buddha. In the Buddha Dharma alone, he trains for the sake of all knowledge, no training in his training, and no one is trained in his training. Increase or decrease of forms is not the aim of this training, nor does he set out to acquire various dharmas. All knowing, all knowledge alone, he can hope to acquire by this training. To that he goes forth when he trains in this training and delights in its virtues. So this is This is a deep pondering on the nature of impermanence and exist, not exist, all of that. Because to train as a bodhisattva is not to learn how to train others. See, we all get stuck on that, don't we? Oh, there's no way I can teach other people how to practice Buddhism. I'm just not smart enough. I just don't know enough. I just don't. So this very stanza speaks to you. It says you were worrying about how to train others. And in doing that, you've taken your eye off the ball. Your training as a bodhisattva is to deeply engage in your Buddha nature. That in itself you could call your training, but it is not the training of training. It is the mental attention to your coursing, going through life with Buddha as your objective. And in so doing, you are affecting and influencing your environment, putting yourself in the environment, not solipsistically illusion, being by yourself, but moving, coursing through the world with this as your goal. Others are learning, teaching themselves as they observe you. You needn't be concerned about what words to use, what training, what stages, what the perfect things to say. All of that is a negligible thing. It's an earthbound samsaric thing. It is by nature your presence, coursing in bodhisattva, coursing in your mental dedication to Buddha way, that others will learn from you. And whatever comes out of your mouth with that compassion of Buddha in your mind state will be what they need to hear. But if you contrive to come up with words to train others, you will fail. Or you will become an obstacle to yourself and to them. So don't preoccupy yourself with samsara. Preoccupy yourself with Buddha-ness. With Buddha-ness, we can influence others in the way that they need to be influenced, because we cannot see that, right? So in the Lotus Sutra, we have the perfect method for doing that. Because by saying Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, by training or teaching others how to say Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, they then have the formula to awaken themselves. So you needn't worry that they're not understanding, not knowing the words. The only thing they need to know is Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. From then on, it's their will, their volition, their effort that brings them to enlightenment. What you then are is a facilitator, a supporter, right? Hey, you taught me Buddhism, or you told me something about it months ago, and I thought I wanted to get into it more. Could you tell me more about Buddhism? Sure, why don't we get together and chant? Let me come to your house, and or if you don't have a gohonzon yet or a butsudan set up yet, then come over to mine and let's chant. And then we can chat about life, but let's chant. You're a facilitator. You're helping them to attain their own enlightenment. We have no easier method than the Daimoku. Bring them to your mandala of gohonzon. Let them enliven their gohonzon. They'll do it. Because we all innately search for this release from stress, anxiety, life, right? We don't want to leave life. We just want to experience it fully, free of obstacles, right? So that's your job as a bodhisattva. Just get them to chant. Lead them to the water. You can't force a horse to drink, but you can lead them to the water, right? I don't mean to say other people are horses, but I mean, what I'm saying is culturally, historically, we know this. So don't get in your own way. What can I say to this person to make them practice? Not. All you need to do is teach them to chant. Because that is the easiest method for them to attain Buddhahood. Not Arhant. Not Ichantika. You jump right over that. Right? The last sentence, to that he goes forth when he trains in this training and delights in its virtues, the training of no training, the not training of training, however you want to say it. It is a light bulb going on in the mind that says, oh yeah, I don't need to get so involved in the particulars of samsara. All I need to do is stay focused on the prize. And if I say, here, prize, then you get it. I have to have confidence. And this is probably the key word for us all the time. When we chant, when we do gongyo recitations, when we meet others, have confidence. Oh, you're curious? Namu myo renge kyo. Yeah, say it. Namu myo renge kyo. Namu myo renge kyo. Namu myo renge kyo. You want to do it together? Come on, let's do it together. Boy, this guy's a little weird. Who cares if that's what they think? It's not important. You don't have to win their affection. You don't have to win even their confidence. Because the only one who wins confidence is the self. Everything else is manipulation. It's the world of anger. You don't want to be there, right? Just be in Myoho Renge Kyo. How amazing is that? So basically, that's what this says. Of course, we know this because we know Lotus Sutra. We know the ultimate teaching, right? The facts of existence. And then the conclusion. Shall we finish this second chapter? How much time do we have? Oh, sure, we got lots of time. The facts of existence should be interesting. Forms are not wisdom, nor is wisdom found in forms. Right? Name and form. Form. Human form. Glasses form. Computer form. Cloud forms. Rivers forms. Right? Everything that is perceivable by a samsaric mind has form. Even gases have a form. Especially when you consider looking at those forms deeper and deeper, we know molecular structure, atoms, right? All the way down to the initial amalgams of energy. It's all form, name and form, right? So if you're looking for wisdom, again, like what proper words do I use? Those are forms. If you're looking for proper forms, the wisdom is not in the forms. In consciousness, perceptions, feeling, or in will, they are not wisdom, and no wisdom is in them, right? The skandhas, the consciousnesses, they're tools for us to perceive samsarically. And once we awaken our Buddha mind, we transcend all of those lenses. We still use them, but we use them entirely differently. So the wisdom comes from Myoho Renge Kyo, not from the tools, right? The plumber we call to fix our leak is the source of the wisdom, not the tools he uses, right? Like our skandhas. Bad analogy, but you understand. That's funny. Okay. They are not wisdom, and no wisdom is in them. Like space it is, without a break or a crack. It's unfortunate that it came up with the plumber analogy there. Sorry. Anyway, like space. So, 2,300 years ago, or 3,000 years ago for that matter, they did not conceive of space the way that we do today. But still, it holds that our skandhas, our tools of perception, are like space. Space seen at that time as formlessness. The space between forms is not form. Yet today we know that it is, that space isn't the same word as time, space, time, right? But this duration, though it has a form we can understand today, at that time was a good example for where formlessness might, at least in the mind, exist or not exist, right? Of all objective supports, the essential original nature is boundless. What is the essential original nature? We talked about this in the last video. Wuji, potential, unformed energy, no karma. Karma is energy plus work. It's instantiation. It's, sorry, got distracted. Monkey mind. Of all objective supports, the essential original nature is boundless. Of beings likewise, the essential original nature is boundless. So again, this is stating what we talk about all the time, our Buddha nature, the nature of all things, all phenomena, begins with karmic instantiation, right? The amalgams of karma, the broiling amalgams that instantiate name and form, right? The nidana. All phenomena start from this. And we can call that, knowing of that, Buddha-ness. To be aware that formations are arising, enduring, decaying, and going extinct, as the true nature of all phenomena, releases us from the grip of those phenomena. Yeah? So that nature, that knowing, that Buddha-ness has been there from the start, because before anything was attachable, it was energy, potential, and equating it here with Buddha-ness. But Buddha-ness, as you and I know, is a realization and a mental cognition of this state of affairs. So I don't want to mislead you into thinking that Buddha is pre-existence. It isn't. It is the experience of knowing that all things are moment to moment experiences to be had while in this samsaric form, with the knowledge of how they've all come about and are going to dissipate. That they are temporary, no need of attachment to persist them, right? To be, wanting to possess, wanting to hold, wanting to maintain. That's the samsaric condition. If we can rise above that condition, we can see the play of all phenomena as an amazing experience. An experience, albeit, that we can only have while within this samsaric existence. Not before or after. That's just knowledge of how this has come about. So I don't want you to think that Buddha is quiescent energy and potential. No, Buddha is the mental experience of knowing that is the essential nature of all phenomena. You see the difference? As the essential original nature of space has no limits, just so the wisdom of the world knowers is boundless. So that's an interesting choice of words to explain what I was just saying. As the essential original nature of space has no limits, as the essential original nature of all form, Wu Ji, energy without work, energy transcending energy with work, creating kinetics, momentum, karma. So if we understand pre-karma and the formations that come that create karma, all of name and form, all of this, we're not trying to escape this. We're not trying to get rid of those eight consciousnesses, are we? We are trying to cleanse them. We are trying to look through those lenses with the amazement appropriate to seeing them as unattached to our perception, to our understanding, to our knowledge, right? Just so the wisdom of the world knowers is boundless. World knowers, not detached, non-bodily, not form, not hovering clouds of self. That's still samsara. But in samsara, knowing, in other words, understanding the mechanism of all phenomena, that is enlightenment. And that enlightenment is boundless. Perceptions, mere words, so the leaders have told us, perceptions forsaken and gone, and the door is open to the beyond. Those who succeed in ridding themselves of perceptions, they, having reached the beyond, fulfill the teacher's commandments. If for eons, countless as the sands of the Ganges, the leader would himself continue to pronounce the word being, still, pure from the very start, no being could ever result from his speaking. That is the practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. Does that make sense? If for eons countless the sands of time, the leader would himself continue to pronounce the word being, still, pure from the very start, no being could ever result from his speaking. This is, again, we're talking about the mind. When you fully perceive the nature of all phenomena as this truly uninvested karma, flow of energy and instantiations, when you truly see yourself apart from the rapids and observe, you may use the words of the rapids. You may use the word of while I'm here, the I and all of that, because that is the vehicle of samsaric communication. But that would not instantiate yourself in this realm, because you're coursing in Buddha, right? That is the practice of perfection of wisdom. The conclusion, and so the Jinna concludes his preaching and finally tells us, quote, when all I said and did at last agreed with perfect wisdom, then this prediction I received from him who went before me, fully enlightened, at a future time, thou shalt a Buddha be. So in this training, in this constant disassociation, we disassociate with the mechanisms of samsara. While in samsara, when we reach that point, when we can course as a bodhisattva within samsara without being touched by it, affected by it, and because we're in it, move our influence through it simply by coursing in the Buddha mind, we can participate in samsara, bodhisattva, without descending into all of the skandhas, all of the attachments, all of the form. We can enjoy, we can eat, we can enjoy all of the forms, but we understand with each bite of food that this is a provisional action of that samsara requires, but our enlightened, our Buddha does not require. Our mental awareness, our mind of Buddha, exists without all of this, but within it, unattached, uninfluenced, and therefore liberated to enjoy all of it. It's hard to say in words. Speaking of words, I'm curious. So we hear the word jina a lot, and I'm aware that I haven't given you a definition for that. And there is one in the back of the book, and their estimation of the sense of that word is conqueror, the epithet of the Buddha. So you could say an enlightened one, a Tathagata, in the place of, and so the jina concludes, and so the Buddha concludes his preaching. But again, I caution you that there's Buddha concludes his teachings sounds like a person is teaching. But that is not what this means. It means this enlightenment state, this conqueror of samsara, with it, that Buddha knowledge puts this to rest. It uses the male form his, but only because this is the reference of samsaric language. So when your Buddha concludes this lesson, her knowledge, see, it doesn't have to be a him, but this is modern thinking, right? You couldn't have said that back then, and people would have shot you, stoned you. Right? Because women can't attain enlightenment. What are you talking about? Her. Fortunately, we don't live in that time anymore. We know better. Right? All right. So that concludes chapter 2. And next we'll move on to chapter 3, which starts out with the merit derived from perfect wisdom. The rewards of Buddhahood. Right? So, I look forward to that. Chew on what we've talked about today. I think by now you should be understanding that perfection of wisdom is another rhetoric for samsarically with the mind, because that's what wisdom is, right? So, the perfection of that wisdom in samsara is to attain a state of mind that not only is unaffected by the tendencies and conditions of samsara, but while in samsara as bodhisattva, this condition affects everyone around us, everything and everyone. And so this is this coursing in perfection of wisdom, something that can only occur in samsara. So I hope I've made that point really, really, really clear. That Buddha-ness, Buddhahood, can only be achieved in the here and now, in this samsaric existence, because it is a condition that by its very definition exists in transcendence of something else, in objective separation from the subjective everything else. So it is a living condition, something we experience here and now. It isn't a land that we're going to far away. It isn't something we find after we die. And it isn't something that existed prior to our samsaric existence, albeit in other samsaric existences. But for we personally, our experience, this Buddhahood, which all can experience, is specific primarily to us because of our subjective reality. We can release ourselves from that subjective reality only while we are in it, because that is what maintains our mind. And when we attain the Buddha mind, there is no separation between all of us living and all phenomena. What is that like? That's much, much, uncalculably much larger than a self. The self then becomes the universe. What is that? How does that feel? Right? There's a skanda feeling. When we reach that, we don't need the feeling, but we can experience the feeling, albeit through the Buddha lens. It's a completely different thing. It's no longer an attachment. It's a samsaric experience and a color of an aspect, but not one we're attached to, not one we need, we desperately want to maintain. No. Everything becomes clarified in its appropriate place, if you will. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. That's all we need do. That's all we need share. Right? Rather than teaching and learning, sharing has a different onus to it, doesn't it? Words are funny. Thank you for participating. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being kind. Your generosity is amazing. Your practice is even more amazing. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. I will see you in the next one, Chapter 3. And then Sunday we'll start on a different sutra. We'll get back to this, but I want to bounce around a little bit week to week so we could start to see the flavors of this teaching. All of it points us to the Lotus Sutra, does it not? Yes. All right. Take care. Be kind to yourself and others. And I will see you soon. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo.